Today, noticing, admitting, when something's gone wrong with faith.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I actually have a couple of examples of this, and they come from long observations in our culture, our community, our region, but they also come from an observation about what Scripture teaches about Christianity and how we live it out, and then in some ways comporting with it, but in other ways in contrast to it, how we actually live out our faith. And you'll see as we go through this conversation today with the one example. Now, I said I have two examples, but we're only going to bring up one today. And we will hopefully get to the next one in a subsequent episode. But with the example today that I'll give, you'll notice as we speak through this that I will use the word faith, which has a variety of meanings. It has a whole range of meanings. They're all tied together. They all have a connection, not just in the pronunciation of the word, but there is a connection between them. But there's a difference between the faith defined objectively as a set of creeds that are held, you know, and so on. And then there's the faith as it's practiced within a certain community. And then they're all different kinds of ways to use the faith. But the two ways that you'll hear me using it today are a way that pertains to that objective content, the reality of what Christ left for us in Scripture and in his own sacrifice and in the eternal reality of heaven and the expectation of our response to that, the reality, the metaphysical truth of this faith that we hold. But then there is on the subjective side of it, the way we practice the faith. And so when I say faith has gone bad, I do mean the way we practice our faith can go bad. And obviously that can be the case in any way that we err. A doctrinal error would be faith going bad. But these are more practical or a crossover between the way we practice the things that we say we believe and then the things themselves that we say we believe if we're consistent about what we do. And so I want to give a couple of examples of this over time, but the example that I would come to today is this. When therapy, and in both cases, there's a sort of contradiction that arises here. So, but in this first example, it's when therapy, and I don't mean a particular form of therapy or anything like that, but sort of a therapeutic model of dealing with human infirmities, right? So a way of saying we're going to do therapy, we're going to practice medicine, we're going to use psychology, we're going to do some kind of work to bring about a change in someone's life, that therapeutic model of dealing with human infirmities. When therapy or a therapeutic model becomes the enemy of redemption or a redemptive model in our relationship with people. And again, just for the basic concept, you can understand that there could be a tension. There doesn't have to be, but there could be, and there certainly is, a tension between a model that says, oh, here's a person doing bad things, for instance, and I'm going to provide for them a solution by counseling them or giving them advice or putting them through a series of trainings, disciplines, or something like that, and make them a better person, you know, over time. You can see why there could be a stark difference between that model of dealing with people and the model that says, oh, here's a person that's bad, they're in some way erring, and I'm going to get them to be transformed in a moment through a prayer. And that's saying it the cheap way, but it also is a real way that we talk about lives being transformed in a moment. And I've had friends who've been transformed in both ways, and I mean it involved both items. But I will say I've had a friend who when he was completely addicted to cocaine, and he always says he was so addicted to cocaine, if he'd had a cheap alternative, he would have died during those years. If he'd had crack as an option, he would have died in those years. But when he was young, he was addicted to cocaine, and he just could not escape it. He came to faith in Christ and never took the drug again, never took any drug again, never went back at all, went from being a complete addict to being completely free of it in a moment of redemption. I have a friend like that, and I have other friends who have taken ages to go through the process of sanctification to experience freedom from debilitating habits or behaviors in their life. I've seen it on both sides. And I don't condemn one and bless the other. I love the testimony of each for its different reason. But you can see the difference between those two understandings of what happens in people's lives and our tendency to pick only one as the way it has to happen all of the time. And so, obviously, I would say, you know, we have to learn not to be so narrow in our understanding of how God works in people's lives to bring about transformation in them. But along those lines, I have encountered this reality. And I'll bring it up in one particular context, and it's what makes me bring up this example. And it's the context of sexual abuse in the churches. So when I say churches, I mean larger context denominations or religious movements. So in the Catholic Church, the sexual abuse scandal that was there, and in the Southern Baptist Church, the scandal that's there with the Sex Abuse Task Force report that came out just this last year. I'll use, obviously, being Southern Baptist, will use that context because I'm more familiar with it as sort of a basis for this opening part of the conversation, because this is where I've heard it talked about. But I know this is true theologically and psychologically in a lot of believers' minds and in the minds of a lot of people who view religion in this way. And that is, there are all kinds. So when the report came out, there was, you know, there's an obvious, it seems to me that there is an obvious response, which is contrition and humiliation, but also repentance and a willingness to do anything, to take steps to make things better, to make things right. We can't go back and fix the past, but we can acknowledge honestly where the damage has been done, and by being honest about it, accept whatever consequences come with that in order to make things right going forward. It seems to me that's the only reasonable response to this. And we had an entire conversation about this before the Sexual Abuse Task Force report was given to the convention, before it was even completed. And there was all of this debate and discussion about whether privilege should be waived and people should give all of the information that's necessary to the people who were putting together the report and all of that. We had an interview about that with Jared Wellman and others who were talking about, and Andrew Hebert, who were talking about the importance of us handling it correctly. And fortunately, it ended up being handled correctly. But then the response to that is what we do with it as believers when we have the information in front of us. And in both contexts, before the report was put out, before it was even finished, and before it was put out, and now after it's come out and been adopted by the convention or accepted in its form by the convention, and we acknowledge that we need to do something with it, in that context, oddly, there is not unanimity. Now, there is an overwhelming majority that's indicated its desire for us to respond appropriately to this report. So I'm not trying to pretend I'm battling some battle that's not there. But there is a battle present. And it is between those who say that, oh, we have to respond and do everything possible to make these things right, including some things I'll mention in a moment. But then there's also another side to that. And people who are responding and saying, I don't think this report is good. And why did we have a secular organization examining whether we had sexual abuse problems in our churches when we should be going to people who know the Lord and so on like that? You know, when I hear those things, I mean, part of me just wants to respond and say, "Oh, how can you respond that way? And what's wrong with your thinking?" But the other part of me, it inherently says, "Why is it that people would say that? Why is it that they're hesitant to accept the report?" And then I realize what's going on in that I have heard that is whispered and not spoken out loud, and that's what I want to share. So there are all kinds of reasons people try to avoid the implications and responsibilities that go with a report like the Sexual Abuse Task Force report at the Southern Baptist Convention, or in the Catholic Church, the sex abuse report that came back to them. There are all kinds of reasons. There are pragmatic reasons. Well, we can't make things right anyway, and we have all kinds of issues that we would have to deal with that are just impossible for us to solve, you know, knots too complicated to untie. There are personal reasons. Well, I know Fred, and I just don't think he's a bad person. He made a mistake, and why do we have to hold this over his head for the rest of his life? And there are institutional reasons. What if we're sued and we lose all of our money and all of our resources shut down, and then we're not able to go out and do the job that we're supposed to, and so on? But there's also naivety. You know, it's not that bad. It's just not what you think it is, and so on. There are all kinds of practical reasons like that people respond the way they do, pushing back against this kind of report. But that's not what I want to talk about. This is what I want to talk about: the whispered theological underpinning to some of the resistance, because I've heard it. I heard it before this report was even a twinkle in the eye of its author, so to speak. I heard it long ago in the context of establishing counseling as a discipline and psychology as a discipline at Criswell College, where I'm the president and I love serving and I love the support that I have here. I have heard this for ages, and I think I have not taken seriously enough the gap that this particular whispered theological inclination creates. And it is this: it's a distrust in a therapeutic model for dealing with human struggles or inadequacies or infirmities. And I know that sounds strange and technical and sterile, but it's a really important distinction to make. And you should know that there are a lot of leaders in Christian living in general, theological leaders, pastoral leaders, educational leaders, and so on, who have that distrust for a therapeutic model of dealing with, as I said, human struggles, inadequacies, and infirmities. And so, you know, what am I talking about with that, a therapeutic model, let's just say, of human nature? And this is, and again, I'm not basing this on some theory in a book that I read somewhere, but on conversations I've had, actual encounters I have had with people who have expressed their concern this way. I don't know how many. I just know representatively, for me, it's a significant number. And it's not evilly rooted, if I can make that into an expression. I don't find it ill-motivated, malevolent in some way. And yet I think the consequence of it can be that. That's the point of saying that we need to learn how to notice or admit when something's gone wrong with our faith, when it's turned into a bad faith. And so these conversations that I've had with theologians, pastors, educators, laypersons all along the way, they are in response to the idea, this therapeutic idea of human nature, that it's possible to improve a person through natural processes, physiological processes, psychological processes, whatever. So, for example, and you may be saying, well, I have a problem with that myself. I believe a person's got to be saved. I understand. Hang in there. Let's talk about it. But by example, what I mean by this, the ability to improve a person through natural processes, think about it, using pharmaceuticals as an example. This is just an example. It's not the whole thing. But using pharmaceuticals, drugs, you know, to manage depression or anxiety or childhood attention disorders of some kind or manias or whatever is going on in a person's brain or in their mind, in their experience. Using pharmaceuticals to treat that kind of condition is therapeutic. We're looking for a way to improve the person's condition, and we're doing it with a natural means, a natural process. and it may or may not suffice, and so we'll try other methods, and those are therapeutic methods as well. This is a therapeutic approach to dealing with some kind of a problem, a struggle, an inadequacy, or an infirmity. And surely you've heard this. I mean, there is the only circles I can talk about are the ones I've been in, and in Southern and conservative and Christian circles, there was a certain amount of shame that people associated with taking that kind of approach to their own weakness or infirmity. We didn't want to admit that we might be depressed and therefore went to see a doctor and they gave us a drug and now I'm taking a medication so that I can have my mindset properly. That seemed humiliating and embarrassing because we didn't have enough faith in God to find our solution there. So you can see how the controversy would arise to become what it is. That's exactly the mindset that I'm talking about, the one that distrusts a therapeutic model for dealing with our struggles or inadequacies or infirmities of any kind. So another example, aside from pharmaceuticals, would be using any kind of treatment to help a person who has psychological or behavioral or relational issues. So behavior modification or talk therapy, or my producer uses, I think, CBT, she calls it, cognitive behavior therapy. I don't even have a good sense of what that is, but she seems to think it's all the thing. As a licensed counselor, she does. So the point I'm making is that any of those would be therapeutic in nature. It's a way of saying, oh, I'm going to use a natural resource, a natural means for trying to help you solve a problem that you have, help you deal with some weakness or infirmity or inadequacy or struggle that you're going through. Why is it that people would oppose that? And let me be clear with this part, and this is important. This is not the debate. And for those of you who don't know what this is, I'll only be on this a minute. You don't believe me because you don't think I can do anything for only a minute. But I really do mean not a minute, but, you know, a couple of minutes, a few. I'm not debating. This is not a discussion about nouthetic versus integrative counseling. That's not what this is. That's for a different episode and a different discussion, and I think it's worth having, and it's important, and we use an integrative model at Criswell College as we teach psychology and counseling. But I think both kinds, nouthetic and integrative counseling, I get it, but both kinds have room for both therapeutic and redemptive responses to human needs. So this is not an argument or a debate between nouthetic and integrative counseling. Different discussion. I will say, it's funny that this is the case, there are some denigratory remarks that are made from each side toward the other that can help, that make us slip into thinking that it is that discussion. But that's a mistake. It's a caricature. So I know there are integrative thinkers who believe in using counseling that, you know, come from naturalistic thinkers and stuff like that. There are integrative thinkers who look at nouthetic people and say, well, they just give them a Bible verse and tell them, wave their hand and say, it'll be okay, just trust God. But that's a caricature of nouthetic counseling. That's not what it is, and so on. So that's not a fair, it's sort of a straw man type of argument. But those fallacies that are involved in that are for a different discussion. And also the idea of the fallacies that are involved in it would be for another discussion. And we love talking about logic on this show as well. And we haven't done one of those in a while. We need to do another episode about that, logical fallacies. Anyway, why is it then, if it's not about the nouthetic and integrative counseling ideas, why is it that there are people who oppose this idea of therapeutic treatments? Because they view it, and this is not everyone, I'm just saying in these conversations that I've had with quite a few people where I've heard this concern, they view it as contrary to a redemptive model of human nature, as being incompatible with a redemptive model of human nature. And it's something like this. This is a slight caricature, but not much. It's pretty close. It is as if a redemptive model is based on grace. I've actually heard people say this, but they don't represent everyone who says this. But they're very direct about it. A redemptive model is based on grace. God intervenes and he brings, through no merit of your own, a transformation to your life that solves those problems that were crippling you before. You know, that idea, which is a wonderful thing about salvation and the nature of the grace of God, which we receive purely by faith. So I believe in salvation by grace through faith. I believe in Ephesians 2, you know. So, this opposition is based on the idea that the redemptive model is based on grace, but a therapeutic model, it's as if a therapeutic model is based on works. And further, as if a therapeutic model, therefore being based on works, must embrace fully a melioristic understanding of humanity. I know not everybody uses that word. I get it. But meliorism is this idea. It's, you know, it's based on this Greek word for healing or therapy, melo. So the idea of meliorism is that man can heal himself, that he can solve all of his own problems. And usually we use it culturally, where we're saying we can solve the problems of humankind, solve the problems of hunger, solve the problems of disease. But then we extend it to say we can solve social problems, like B.F. Skinner did in Beyond Freedom and Dignity, a book in the mid-20th century. Those kinds of ideas are melioristic. And a melioristic understanding of humanity is one that says we don't need divine intervention. We need people to give a dime apiece to the March of Dimes to cure diseases and solve problems. And let's just apply man's power to solving these problems. That melioristic model of humanity normally does end up pushing the idea of salvation and redemption and eschatology and God's divine intervention for the sake of that redemptive act out of the picture. It's true that that's the case with a lot of people who pursue this melioristic understanding of humanity. But there's a big difference between adopting this fully melioristic understanding of our culture and holding a therapeutic model of the recovery of people from certain behaviors or certain weaknesses or problems. And so I just want to pause first and think about that opposition, whether they really do stand against each other. So let's give the example of pharmacology again. So psychopharmacology particularly, because Most believers that I know, not all, some believers I know actually do apply that divergence between therapeutic and redemptive mindsets even to physical medical care. So, you know, we don't do blood transfusions or we don't believe in surgery or we don't give medicines to people. There are people like that. And that's, I'm not attacking that. I just want to point out that's the vast minority. Now, most people are okay with giving someone aspirin for pain relief or going to the hospital if you need to have a bone set or, you know, things like that. It's not just prayer and the healing will take place for physical infirmities. But when it comes to the mind, suddenly we're very cautious about it because the mind is a territory that seems a lot less material and therefore a lot more confused with the nature of spirit to us. And so in psychopharmacology, we're okay with using therapeutic remedies for maladies, you know, aspirin for headaches, bandages for cuts, herbal poultices that are therapeutic, even if you don't believe in the pharmaceutical industry, you know, just going out and gathering plants and bundling them up and putting them with hot water or castor oil or something and wrapping them around a wound is still therapeutic. But we say there's something different about the mind because it's non-material and therefore it's the dominion of the soul. And we're uncomfortable sometimes transferring that therapeutic model to the way the mind works without feeling like we're giving up this space that we had carved out for God still to be active, and now we're pushing him out of that space too. And so we think in particular, you know, where there are some mental issues, that we can't apply the therapeutic solution to it without saying that what Scripture said about overcoming fear is no longer true, that our salvation should overcome fear, and so on. Or in behaviors, we do the same thing. If we're applying it to behaviors, we think there's something different about behaviors, that you can't use therapy to fix a behavior because the domain where we put most egregious sins as we see them are behavioral. Murder, adultery, stealing, Maybe you put lying and coveting into the more mental category, but the big ones, the big three, you know, they're behavioral. And to address that with therapy is to say that salvation isn't really the solution to things anymore. We can feel that way. And so to address mental states and behaviors with something natural in this way of thinking about it seems like an insult to the supernatural. Well, you know, in response to that, there are a couple of things worth saying here. I mean, one is our taxonomy, the way we divide up, you know, the world and categorize it, our taxonomy of natural and supernatural is all wrong. And I've talked about this on episodes before. God's constant presence and work infuse the entirety of creation, the parts we consider natural, the material parts, and then the parts we consider supernatural, which are the non-material parts. They're all part of nature. God created them. They're a part of his creation. Colossians 1:16, you know, for by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. That dichotomy that we create between the natural and the supernatural is just artificial. It's ours. It's not God's. It's not Scripture's. And then second, we create this false dichotomy between faith and works. And it's a parallel dichotomy. They are attached to each other, these dichotomies, as if the difference between faith and works is the difference between spirit and flesh. But it's James who says you can't extract those from each other. As the body apart from the spirit is dead, so faith apart from works is also dead. They go together. These are supposed to comport with each other, not be viewed as enemies of each other. So, you know, there's a strongly parallel debate, which I'd love to get into, about free will. It's very closely related. It's the same idea that if, you know, the argument is that if a person's psychology determines their behavior, then they're not responsible for their behavior. Again, there are so many things I want to say about this. I'm tempted to be distracted and to take the whole show in this direction of talking about free will. That's not what we're doing, so I'm not even going to clarify what my actual position on this is, because that would drag me into the whole conversation. So let me just make this point simply. There is an argument that if your psychology, if your character determines your behavior, then you're no longer responsible for your behavior. I mean, you don't have a choice. That's what you were made to be. You're the person who does that thing. Jonathan Edwards' response to that idea is pretty profound. And again, I'm not Edwardsian. In a Jonathan Edwards sense, I don't follow his determinism or any of his theology that is deterministic. But this argument of his is smart, and this part of it is right. And, you know, that's like me. I'm saying Jonathan Edwards, yeah, he's right. Well, I'm sure he feels much better about himself because I said that. Anyway, the point is, his response to that is to say it doesn't make a person, if a person who has done something because of their character is not less responsible because their character drove them to it. They're more responsible for that activity. They are more morally accountable because their character drove them to it. Because it was determined by their character. It wasn't just a choice, a quirk of a moment, you know? It was part of who they are. And so, you know, so the example would be this. A child is raised by abusive parents. Edwards wouldn't have given this example because the idea of psychical causation wasn't in his world. Freud didn't exist yet. But I want to put it in the whole picture of where we are now. So a child is raised by abusive parents, let's say. And because of that, and we're willing to admit that because we believe in psychical causation. So a child is raised by abusive parents, and partially because of that, not entirely, fine, it's not determined. I'm not a determinist. But partially because of that, becomes a violent person, becomes an abusive person, and in this case, becomes abusive towards strangers. It can manifest in different ways, but in this case, it's abusive towards strangers. And so goes and eventually murders an innocent couple in their home. And let's just say that follows all the, you know, abused animals, and, you know, was a bully, did all those other things on the steps toward becoming this destructive, but finally goes and murders some innocent couple in their home. Now they've been caught. And the defense says, well, it's not their fault. They were raised by an abusive parent. And I'm not just talking about lightly abusive. I mean, we're talking about bad abuses. And this has happened. You know, these things have happened. So I'm not having to make up a case that's not the reality of it. I could give a more painful case, but I don't want to get distracted by the details of that either. But in this example, you know, the response of the defense would be, well, it's not their fault. They were abused as a child and blah, blah, blah. But of course they're responsible. But that doesn't, acknowledging that they're morally responsible, this person broke into an innocent couple's home and slaughtered them in cold blood. Of course we admit they're responsible, but shouldn't we also be willing to admit that the psychological realities of that person's past and the influence they had on shaping them are a part of the reason they became the abusive person that they did? Of course we admit that as well. And if that's the case, by the way, wouldn't we see them before the violence and say, oh, let's intervene here. Let's do something. Well, yeah, let's lead them to Christ and pray for them and bless them. But then let's sit down and talk about how we can modify these behaviors, adjust their way of thinking about the world around them, and so on. And couldn't it be that that intervening would include both of those ideas, leading a person toward faith, but also leading them to serious discussions about how their past abusive experiences may linger in an old flesh which always accompanies believers in our journey through this fallen world? Can't we admit both? So in practical terms, let me back up and let's talk about how this affects this idea of a therapeutic model of dealing with people and how it's viewed as contrary to a redemptive model, how that affects whether we have in some ways, and I just mean we in our community in general, whether it's you personally or not, I don't know, because I don't know what your personal views are on it. I'm saying we as a community, have we in some ways embraced a bad faith? So again, by bad faith, I don't mean the objective content of Christianity. I believe in the resurrection and the power of Christ and his lordship over this world because of the resurrection. I'm grateful for all of that, and I'm committed to all of that. What I do mean by bad faith is the subjective way that we have developed it and defend it and hold it. And there can be a huge difference between what we were left and what we have created out of what was left to us. And this is important. My response to bad faith is not to abandon the faith. There are a lot of people who have observed this bad faith and have deconstructed their faith, and some have reconstructed it in different ways. Others have deconstructed it, and it has simply meant abandoning the faith in general and saying that has no value for us anymore, and they've become opponents to the faith. My response to bad faith is not at all to abandon the faith. And I would point this out to those who are considering deconstructing their faith, that the reason I haven't abandoned my faith is because when the reason I'm troubled by the people who I think hold the faith in error is because of what the faith itself taught me. I'm not troubled because I have some superior moral insight. I really am disturbed by some of the things I see being practiced in our own community of faith because of what the faith has taught me. That's why I have this perspective. And so abandoning the faith in the face of errors, I believe, that we're practicing in the way we carry it out wouldn't make sense to me. My reason for trying to address these things is the thing that faith itself taught me. So when I see hypocrisy among us or in myself, it bothers me because I think of what Jesus said about hypocrisy. So I wouldn't abandon Jesus because he criticized the thing that I'm seeing in myself or in others. And I don't. But I get it. Emotionally and in terms of our psychology and the way we've built our communities, it is almost irredeemable at times when you see your own faith having been violated, the one you were taught by that person is violated by that person, then I understand why It is almost a compulsion to leave that faith behind, not just to correct the person. I get that. But I'm not inclined in that direction. I can't do that. The thing that motivates me to talk about all of this is that I do care about those issues in the faith. So let's apply them specifically to the Sexual Abuse Task Force and the report that came out of it, and then the resistance that comes against that as well. So here's the task force and its report, and there are those of us who believe that change is essential if we're going to be true to our calling. And that's the core of it. If we're just going to be true to the thing we were called to be as believers, we have to do the right thing here. And that includes that we need communication between churches about abusers, that there needs to be and I don't care what it is, a database or a report or some kind of accounting that where we say, hey, this person has been convicted of or indicted on or whatever the proper threshold would be of sexual abuse, and therefore you should know before you hire him or before he looks at a position in your church that this is the case. We believe there should be communication between churches about abusers, and we believe that abusers are disqualified from serving in the church context. And there are some who resist those changes. And the reason for that is that they believe in the power of redemption to overcome those things. Now, that's not the only reason. There are a lot of practical reasons I mentioned above. But in the context of this conversation, this is the reason that I want to address. And this regards all of those things where we would say, oh, no, we need to share the information between churches and disqualify people when they've abused and so on. Shouldn't label a person, the response comes, just because they've made a mistake. This is very similar to the idea of resistance to the notion of the Alcoholics Anonymous type of statement, you know, where you begin every meeting with, I'm using the way it's characterized, so I don't know if this is 100% accurate, but where you begin the conversation with, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And for some, you know, the resistance to that language. Well, you're not still an alcoholic. You were redeemed from that. You're not guilty of it anymore. For some conversations, it's just a definitional problem. It's just a disagreement on how we're using the term. So an alcoholic, as that, and I'm putting that in quotes, that statement, I'm an alcoholic. The words an alcoholic doesn't have to be that statement. Doesn't have to be the statement, I am a consumer of alcohol. An alcoholic could simply be a person with a proven propensity to alcohol abuse. And maybe that's what they mean. I don't know exactly what they mean when they utter that statement. But the nature of saying, well, you don't have to say that for the rest of your life, to people who want to say it for the rest of their life so that they can maintain a certain level of accountability, could just be that simple. Well, you're just using the terms differently. When he says, I'm an alcoholic, when she says, I'm an alcoholic, what she means is, I know I have a predisposition to fall back into alcoholism at any moment, right? But accepting the label, here's a person with propensity to abuse, not the one that says they are abusing right now, like, I'm an alcoholic, this person is an abuser. Well, here's a person with a propensity to abuse. It is still the case that saying that seems to discount the strength of redemption. But I want to contest that that's not true. That saying if a person has abused, that acknowledging that abuse from that day forward and saying, you know, this is something you should be aware of as you're approaching this person about a position at your church or whatever, that does not violate at all the strength of redemption that's described in Scripture. It is the point Paul is making in Galatians 6:1 when he's speaking to people who are strong enough in their faith, in their spirit, that he's saying when people have succumbed to the flesh and have failed morally, that you should be the one to redeem them, to remedy their weakness, to carry them forward. That those people, the strong ones that he's speaking to, are the ones to whom he says this. So first he says what to do with the fallen. So brothers, if anyone's caught in a transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness, but keep watch on yourself, lest you also be tempted. I am a sinner. No, you've been redeemed. Yeah, I have been redeemed but I got a propensity to sin. And I know that's true, and all of us ought to know it's true. And there ought to be a willingness to acknowledge that when a person has been guilty of a particular, and in this case, a sin that involved harming another person directly, involved someone we're supposed to protect, that we'd be willing to continue to use that language and say, yeah, we want this to be known. That faith requires, and this is an issue, that faith requires that a redeemed or a forgiven person, having been cleansed by the blood of Christ, be trusted again, is a mistake. Not that they not be loved or embraced or involved in the fellowship or included in the acts of discipleship or grateful for forgiveness or any of that. But for instance, with abusive spouses, this view holds the idea that once they've been forgiven, well, you know, all is forgotten and just go back. And so ministers have told abused wives to go back to their abusive husbands. This is not an acknowledgement simply of the power of redemption, but ignoring the power of the old flesh and our natures in reality in this fallen world. And the need to acknowledge that is critical. So in the same way, that kind of faith, it says, well, once you're redeemed and forgiven, you've been cleansed, you know, you have to be completely trusted. Allowing a repentant or even one who acknowledges it humbly, a repentant molester or abuser to move on without a report to another ministry, which is usually done out of compassion for that abuser, is only compassion for the abuser. It's not compassion for the abused, and it's certainly not compassion for those who will be abused in the future. Nor is acknowledging that others will be abused somehow defaming to the power of Christ and the reality of redemption. The struggles of this world are a part of the reality the New Testament deals with in every epistle of the New Testament. It confuses the power of Christ to redeem us from sin with the rationale, and this is a shameful confusion, with the rationale which allows abusers to move from one abuse to the next, from one context to the next, from one victim to the next. If our view of Christ's redemptive power, and this is the core of what I wanted to talk about with bad faith, if our view of Christ's redemptive power produces such heinous neglect of the fundamental responsibility Christ took, you know, when he cared for the abused, the neglected, the rejected, and that responsibility that he's given to us, if our view of Christ's redemptive power causes in us a neglect of that fundamental responsibility to care for the abused and the neglected and the rejected, then our faith has gone bad. That's just all there is to it. It is essential, then, that we make peace between traditions which have historically been at odds. We can pray and practice medicine. We've learned that. I think most of us have acknowledged that. And because of that, I believe it's possible for us to learn this other as well. We can lead people to forgiveness and provide counsel to help them deal with an old clinging nature. We can believe wholly in the power of redemption and practice daily the disciplines of improvement, of sanctification, of self-control. We can practice forgiveness. On the flip side of that, we can practice forgiveness and exercise the care of accountability and responsibility to the community for past violations of trust. Not only does Christianity allow us to be both and, you know, not either or, you got to be redemptive or you got to be therapeutic. Those are your two options. Not only does Christianity allow us to be both and instead of either or in these examples, it requires it. It's the faith that was given to us. We believe in caring for the body so we can serve the Spirit, capital S, who changed us. We believe in caring for the mind so that it can know the fullness of Christ's indwelling. We believe in responsibility and accountability because we believe Christ made us part of a community. Perfection is not good's enemy, but it's hope. And redemption is not the enemy of improvement, but it's reason for having real, lasting hope of success.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.